You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
We all remember the series of surreal events that took place in Salisbury 2 years ago, when a military-grade nerve agent was used to poison a Russian citizen and his daughter living there at the time. Dawn Sturgis, who had nothing to do with the attempted assassination, unknowingly sprayed herself with the agent Novichok from a bottle which she believed to contain perfume. She never regained consciousness. Since I recorded this interview with Matt Hill of One Crown Office Row, another suspected poisoning has taken place in Russia. On the 22nd of August, the anti-corruption activist Alexei Navalny was flown in a coma from a hospital in Siberia to Berlin. He is still being treated in the German hospital. Going back to the Salisbury poisonings, there was, of course, an inquest into Dawn Sturgis's death. The senior coroner ruled that he would investigate who was responsible for her death, but that he would go no further into the Russian state's possible involvement. Matt Hill has been considering the interaction between coronial and criminal jurisdictions and the tension between these different approaches to those implicated in suspicious deaths. Matt, welcome once again to LawPod UK.
Thank you, Rosalind.
Let's just go back to the Skripal story and just remind ourselves of the details before we get to the judicial review challenge to the coroner's decision.
In March 2018, as you said, there was an attempt to poison Sergei and Yulia Skripal in Salisbury with Novichok, the nerve agent. It seems to have been left on the door of the Skripal's house. The Skripals were found unconscious or semi-conscious in a park in Salisbury and were rushed to hospital and given medical attention. A police officer who was involved in searching the Skripals' house, Detective Sergeant Nick Bailey, was also injured in the case. And although Sergei and Yulia Skripal and Mr. Bailey all survived, Mr. Bailey has said publicly that he thinks that his life will never be the same again. About 4 months later, Dawn Sturgis used what she thought was perfume from a perfume bottle, but which turned out to be Novichok, which had been discarded in the perfume bottle, it's believed, somewhere in Salisbury. There was a criminal investigation that followed, and very sadly, Ms. Sturgis died. The criminal investigation identified two Russian suspects who were named, and charges were brought against them, and European arrest warrants issued. But in reality, there is no prospect of these two men being extradited from Russia. And of course, speculation and comment continues about the involvement of the Russian state in the attempt on Sergei and Yulia Skripal, the injury to Mr. Bailey, and of course, the death of Dawn Sturgis.
This very complicated story, which attracted great public attention, is all subsumed in this inquest. Could I just ask you a very basic question? What are inquests for?
Inquests take place in certain circumstances, including when there has been a violent and unnatural death. And the state is required to investigate such deaths, in essence, in order to ensure that nothing has gone wrong and to explain what has happened. It is a jurisdiction which is governed by statute. So, in other words, Parliament has set out what coroners should do and indeed what they should not do when conducting their inquests. And there are four statutory questions that a coroner must answer. Who died, when, where and how? And in most cases, including in the case of Ms. Sturgis, the question of who died, when and where are all straightforward factual questions. And it is the question of how, which is the one which causes difficulty both legally and evidentially in trying to set what the inquest should do and the questions that the inquest should seek to answer.
And of course, it's in the how question that the scope of the coroner's determination has its boundaries. Is that correct?
That's right. There are two different elements to it which are important to keep distinct, particularly in the case of Miss Sturgis. The first is that the coroner must set the bounds of his or her investigation, and that is usually what is meant by the term scope. So the coroner must decide what he or she is going to look into, which witnesses to call, which evidence to obtain. That will form a decision, or that will be a decision, at a relatively early stage in the inquest. And as the inquest develops and the evidence is called and the witnesses are called and they're tested, the coroner will form a view of what happened. Ultimately, that will be expressed in the coroner's determination, which is the formal record of what results at the end of the inquest. So it is written down and it will enter into the public record and be there for hundreds of years to come. The determination is actually usually quite a short document. It will contain perhaps a paragraph of factual findings about the events immediately before the death, or as many of the events as the coroner feels necessary to record. And then it will also contain what is called a short form conclusion of the type which many people will be aware of. So suicide or accidental death or unlawful killing, which is a way of summarising what the overall finding of the coroner has been. At the end of the inquest, the coroner will be required to produce a determination, which is the formal conclusion of what he or she has decided about the how question and how the person came by their death. That will be a relatively short document, usually a paragraph or so of factual findings, and then what is often referred to as a short form conclusion of accidental death or suicide or unlawful killing. That will be the formal record of the inquest, which will remain in public archives for hundreds of years to come.
But obviously in this case, the Sturgis case, and casting our minds back to another alleged Russian poisoning case, Litvinenko, you have highly secret intelligence evidence which can't be disclosed in public. How does the coroner deal with that?
The short answer is that the coroner can't. The inquest system isn't built for that kind of evidence. A few years ago, the then government made an attempt to introduce closed hearings, which are hearings from which the public and even the parties to the inquest, known as interested persons, could be excluded. But there was fierce resistance to this, and eventually the government backed down. So an inquest cannot have fully closed hearings. That means that where the evidence is highly secretive, highly sensitive of an intelligence nature, an inquest simply can't cope with it. And in those circumstances, coroners generally will write to a minister to seek to alter the forum in which the death is being investigated and change it from an inquest to an inquiry, a public inquiry, usually under the 2005 Inquiries Act.
And does the inquiry have similar limitations as to what the inquiry can determine?
Inquiries can be far broader. The most important distinction, so far as intelligence and sensitive information is concerned, is that inquiries can hear such evidence in closed session. Also, you can ensure that the inquiry is chaired by a judge of high enough standing to allow them access to that evidence, because coroners won't necessarily have that clearance. So that's why they're important in terms of closed hearings. But more generally, an inquiry will be as broad as its terms of reference allow it to be. So whereas a coroner is restricted into answering those four statutory questions, a public inquiry can range far more broadly as long as the terms of reference allow the chair to take that approach.
Going back to inquests, Article 2, the obligation on states to protect the right to life of their citizens, is relevant. And we know that there's a difference between a so-called Jameson inquiry, which doesn't involve Article 2, and a Middleton inquiry, which does. I know Article 2 didn't play a role in the Sturgis case, but could you just expand on how Article 2 makes a difference?
The key case is the case of Middleton, which is a very good example of how the Human Rights Act altered a particular area of English and Welsh law. Prior to Middleton, the leading case on inquest was, as you said, the case of Jameson, which discussed what the how question means in a very lawyerly way. It spent a lot of time and argument and ink on what does how mean. And in the context of inquests, it was determined that how meant by what means. So a really quite narrow question, focusing very much on the immediate cause of death. The key case is Middleton, which is a very good example of how the Human Rights Act has changed the law in England and Wales. Prior to Middleton, and prior to the incorporation of the European Convention on Human Rights, Jameson was the leading case in the colonial jurisdiction, and that discussed what the word how meant in the legislation. The court there determined that how should mean by what means somebody came by their death. So a narrow question which focused very much on the immediate causes of death. Middleton expanded that definition in cases where Article 2 of the European Convention requires an enhanced investigative duty, and I'll come back to what that means in a second. But Middleton changed the definition of how from by what means to by what means and in what circumstances, which is a wider question for the coroner to answer and allows the coroner, critically, to make judgmental findings on failures, particularly by state bodies, but it's been expanded to into failures by non-state bodies as well. So the classic case, and one that arose on the facts of Middleton, is if there is a prison death, if there have been failings in providing care to the prisoner such that a prisoner has been able to take his or her own life, then a coroner may make a finding which is judgmental and highlights a failing. Now, the coroner must be careful how he or she expresses that, because the coroner is still prohibited under the 2009 Act and under its predecessors as well from a determination which appears to determine civil liability or criminal liability on behalf of a named individual. And this is a very important limitation, and it's because a coroner's court is not a criminal court. It is not a civil court. It doesn't have the same procedural safeguards, and it doesn't have the same consequences as those two courts. Therefore, it is limited in what it can say. But Middleton allowed a coroner to use words such as a failure or a missed opportunity, language such as that, to indicate a degree of culpability. But as long as the coroner doesn't declare something to be negligent or a breach of duty, then the coroner doesn't fall foul of a prohibition. The enhanced investigative duty under Article 2 is a very lengthy subject, but in brief, it's this. Article 2 protects the right to life, and it imposes certain obligations on states, the most obvious one of which is not to take life unless there is a lawful and justifiable reason, such as a police officer firing a gun in self-defence. Article 2 also places investigative duties on the state. Now, at the lowest level, one can see this as an extension of what was already there in the domestic law. You can't have people dying violent and unnatural deaths and those being left uninvestigated. So the criminal justice system is part of the state meeting its Article 2 obligations. But where there is an argument that it is state agents who have caused a death, either the classic example being the police officer who fires the bullet, either directly like that or indirectly by not doing something. So again, classic example is not providing sufficient care in prisons to prevent suicide. Then in those circumstances, the state has an enhanced investigative duty where it must look at what its agents have done. And it is in those circumstances that the inquest becomes a Middleton inquest and looks not just at the means by which somebody died, so in the case of a prisoner, suicide, but also the circumstances in which that person died. For example, was that prisoner given sufficient care and placed on sufficient safeguards to prevent the suicide?
And just staying with Article 2 for the moment, but with Sturgis and Litvinenko in mind, what is the obligation on the state when it's agents of another state who are suspected of being behind the death?
This was a question that was addressed directly by the High Court in the recent judicial review application. It was argued before them that Article 2 placed an obligation on the British state to investigate, an enhanced investigative obligation on the British state, to look at the actions of people who were thought to be agents of the Russian state. It was an argument which didn't win favour with the court, who found that there was no authority that supported it, and also that it was somewhat at odds with the principal purpose of Article 2, which, as I've just said, is about a state looking at its own agents. I think it was quite an ambitious argument to run, and the courts were unpersuaded on that, though, as we will hear, they were persuaded on arguments which are more firmly rooted in the domestic statutory legislation.
So going back to domestic law and to your initial question, which is the difference of approaches in criminal as opposed to coronial investigations, there have been a number of cases, haven't there, where this difference of approach has been explored?
Yes. The first thing to say is that this is a very difficult area for coroners for a number of reasons. First, on a human level, the families of the deceased will almost always want as wide a ranging inquiry as they can get, because quite understandably they have questions about how their loved one died. And if there is no criminal trial as an option, then the inquest will be the only public forum in which these matters can be addressed. On a legal level, though, it leaves the coroner in some difficulty because of those prohibitions on what the coroner can say at the end of his or her inquest in the determination, not making a finding of civil liability or criminal liability on behalf of a named person. Coroners are also acutely aware that they are not criminal courts, and indeed not civil courts. They're not set up in that way, and that's not their job. There is a far more relaxed attitude to laws of evidence and rules of questioning, and so the procedural safeguards are far less significant than they are in the criminal or the civil jurisdictions. And coroners are conscious of that, and so they don't want to transgress what their role is and what their role should be. That said, there is that critical distinction between what they can do in their investigation and what they can say in their determination. The best analogy that I've come across of this is one that was used by a barrister called John Hoff, which is a funnel. So at the outset of the inquest, you have a wide funnel, a wide opening into which you pour lots of evidence, some of which will be highly relevant, others perhaps marginally, peripherally relevant. All of it goes into the funnel and it gets distilled down by the process of investigating, by the process of calling evidence, of reading evidence, of questioning witnesses, until at the end you end up with a very distilled conclusion in the form of the determination. A mistake which some people make is to think that the determination of the inquest is the sole purpose of it. It's not. An inquest is designed to be an investigative, inquisitorial process in which the process of looking at all of this material is as important as the final determination which arises at the end, which might be as short as two words, unlawful killing. What's gone before that is where the bulk of the work is done. With those caveats in mind, looking at some of the cases which have straddled the coronial and the criminal jurisdiction, just to give four examples of how this plays out. And at first it will seem that they come to very different conclusions, but actually I think they can be reconciled. The first example is the recent Hillsborough inquests, which concluded with a determination of unlawful killing. Now, it's important that no individual was named in the determination, because that would have breached the prohibition. But anybody who followed the inquests would know that the conclusion of unlawful killing related directly to one individual, which was the chief superintendent who was in command of policing that match. In contrast, the recent Birmingham pub bombings inquests into the IRA attack on pubs in 1974 also concluded with a determination of unlawful killing, but the coroner had ruled out of scope an investigation into who it was who had procured and planned and planted the bombs. The Court of Appeal upheld that as a correct decision in a case called Hambleton. Third example is Ex parte Hart, where the High Court held that the coroner was right to investigate whether or not a death was suicide or whether it was unlawful killing, even though, again, those following the inquests would have been able to see that a finding of unlawful killing clearly implicated one person, although that person wasn't named in the determination. So again, a bit like Hillsborough, you have an implication of who was involved, whereas in Birmingham, you have a decision not to look at who was involved. The final example is the tragic case and the tragic inquest of Poppy Worthington, a child who was allegedly sexually abused shortly before her death. Now, it was agreed that the sexual abuse didn't directly cause the death, but the High Court held that the coroner had lawfully included a reference to it when summing up his findings of fact, on the basis that it explained how Poppy came to be in the parental bed where, tragically, she died of asphyxiation. So those are four different cases which straddle that boundary and do it in rather different ways.
The very broad discretion that the coroner has as to how wide or narrow his or her determination is going to be, without wanting to sound contentious, how is the general public meant to predict what the coroner comes out with?
I think that's a very good question, and it's one the High Court in the Sturgis case quizzically raised an eyebrow about, and the four examples that I've just given demonstrate that, and it leads to a huge amount of discontent amongst family members who feel that their inquests aren't looking at what they want them to look at. I think the key that binds those four cases and the wider coronial jurisdiction together, the question is not who did it, which is usually a question for the criminal courts and sometimes for the civil courts, but how they died. So in the Birmingham pub bombings case, it was possible to answer the question of how the 21 people met their deaths without investigating who it was who planted the bombs and procured the bombs and planned the operation. Those were questions which have been looked at over decades by the criminal courts, and as is well known, has not led to a conviction that has stuck. The Birmingham Six, who were originally arrested and convicted of the crimes, were released some 17 years later. And since then, nobody has been convicted of them. So that was a question that the coroner considered was left for the criminal jurisdiction and was not one that he, as coroner, could resolve. But he could answer the question of how they died without looking at who it was who did it, because it was quite clear that whoever planted the bombs, it was undoubtedly a criminal act which caused the deaths, and it was undoubtedly an unlawful killing. And indeed, the jury determined that it was a murder. In Hillsborough and in Ex parte Hart, those two other examples, in order to get to the question of how those who died in those tragic events died, you need to look at what individuals did. And in those circumstances, the authorities are clear that the coroner can do that, but the coroner can't name the individual as being criminally liable because that is a matter for the criminal courts. But in order to answer how, you have to look at who and you have to look at what they did. In the Poppy Worthington case, the courts upheld the coroner's view that he couldn't answer the question how Poppy died without making reference to what he found to be an incident of sexual abuse beforehand. It wouldn't have answered the question of how. It would have ignored an important piece of the puzzle. And so that is, I think, how you reconcile that. So as long as you are looking at the question of how somebody died, then a coroner has a very broad discretion about where he or she sets the margins of his investigation. But when it comes to his or her determination, they must be more careful in the words that they use, and they must not transgress and seek to make a civil or criminal finding.
As somebody said in the Sturgis judgment, it's the very flexibility of the coronial approach that create some of these inconsistencies.
It does. The flexibility of the coronial system, I think, is in many ways its defining feature, and it is both its strength and its weakness. It's its strength because an inquest will often follow on after a number of other investigations. There might have been a specialist investigation by a body that looks at prison deaths or aircraft crashes or motor accidents or something like that. It may also follow on from a criminal investigation in which there may or may not have been a trial. And so a coronial investigation can sweep up what is necessary in the public interest to look at after those investigations have completed. Or it might form the sole public investigation into a particular death, which might raise concerns for example, the way in which a local hospital is dealing with maternity care. And its flexibility allows it to go into those areas that the public interest requires it to go into. The difficulty is that it's then hard to predict what will and will not be done. And it's hard to advise families about what will and will not be looked at. And of course, it leads to disappointment when coroners decide not to look at a particular area for whatever reason, and indeed can lead to challenge. And the courts are very reluctant to get involved in challenges to the scope of coronial inquests. They're very keen to maintain the coronial discretion, although that is a discretion which, as the Sturgis case shows, must be exercised lawfully.
Given that this is an unusual case where the judicial review in the Sturgis case has been successful, what can the Sturgis family expect is going to happen now?
The reason that it was successful is that the High Court found that the coroner had misapplied the law and had kept in his head the prohibitions on what he could say in his determination and applied them to his investigation. So he had been focused so much about on the fact that he couldn't make a finding of civil liability or criminal liability on behalf of a named person that he had unduly limited the scope of his inquest because he thought that he couldn't go into those areas. The High Court said, well, you can investigate them. You just have to be careful about what you say at the end. The High Court, having quashed the coroner's decision, then remitted it back to him and emphasised that the coroner has a broad discretion and emphasised that just because they've done this, it didn't mean that you would have another case such as the Litvinenko case, which led to a very broad-ranging inquiry, which followed on from the alleged Russian involvement in the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko, a dissident in London, by placing polonium in a cup of tea. And there was originally an inquest that was changed to a public inquiry because it couldn't have closed hearings, and it led to a lengthy public inquiry which concluded that the Russian state was indeed involved in that murder. Now, the High Court said, our decision does not mean that the same will happen to Ms. Sturgis. But it also said this, and I'll just quote a little bit from the judgment. There is acute and obvious public concern, not merely at the prima facie evidence that an attempt was made on British soil by Russian agents to assassinate Mr. Skripal and that it led to the death of Ms. Sturgis, but also at the fact that it involved the use of a prohibited nerve agent, exposing the population of Salisbury and Amesbury to lethal risk. There has been, and to be realistic, there will be, no criminal trial in which the details of how this appalling event came to occur can be publicly examined. Now, the lawyers for Ms. Sturgis' family will, I'm sure, seize on that quotation and say, this is the High Court indicating the degree of public concern about this. The inquest is the only show in town in which this can be examined, and the public interest therefore requires the coroner to examine it and to examine it all the way back, not just to how the Novichok came to be in Salisbury, which is where he had previously drawn the line, but further back to the involvement of the Russian state itself. Whether they're successful is another matter, but I'm sure that is an argument that will be made and will be made with some force. If it is successful and it is necessary to look at the involvement of a Russian state, then it seems to me highly likely that that's going to require sensitive intelligence evidence. And as we've discussed, that can't be done at an inquest. So at that stage, if it gets to that stage, the coroner will have to write to the minister, probably the Home Secretary, and say, well, I can't do this, and I would recommend that you have a public inquiry. It will be for the minister to decide on whether or not to establish that public inquiry and to decide this at a time of extreme tension and sensitivity in the relations between Britain and Russia.
So it looks like the Sturgis family will have a bit of a wait for this to be resolved one way or another.
Sadly, I suspect so.
Matt, thank you very much for taking us through this complicated maze of criminal coronial approaches to suspicious and unlawful deaths.
Thank you very much, Rosalind.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.